Roughly 2,000 years ago, an old man and his wife were preparing to have their 8-day-old baby circumcised. People in the neighborhood were ecstatic. They had known how badly the couple had wanted children, but had long ago given up the idea of raising a family. Then early in that past summer, the old woman made an announcement that a baby had been conceived in her womb. Now the time had come. The baby had been born. There's no blemishes. There's no problems with the baby. And it was time to give the little baby boy a name. This little baby boy was going to be a future priest of Israel, and his name was going to be very important. It was customary in that day to name the children after one of their near relatives, usually the father, who in this case was named Zacharias. So it seemed quite odd that the mother, when asked what his name was to be, said, John. Why John, they thought. Then to get a confirmation of the boy's name, they turned to the father and gave him a little piece of paper to write on, a little writing utensil, because, you know, Zacharias couldn't speak at this time. And Zacharias wrote out the most astonishing thing. He said, John. And then he began to speak. And when he spoke, he said, Blessed be the Lord God of Israel, for he has visited and redeemed his people and has raised up a horn of salvation for us in the house of his servant David, as he spoke by the mouth of his holy prophets from of old, that we should be saved from our enemies and from the hand of all who hate us, to show the mercy promised to our fathers and to remember his holy covenant, the oath that he swore to our father Abraham. Zacharias considered the miracle that happened to him and to his wife, Elizabeth, to have been a result of the covenant promises made to Abraham. And this boy, their son, was a result of the covenant promises that came about, and this boy would eventually be the one who ushered in, prepared the way for the coming of Israel's Messiah. Now, when you look at this picture, you see how ecstatic they are. If you can see the picture, it's sort of a small. No, they're not really ecstatic in this picture. But it is really interesting the way they show this. I don't know if you notice over here, this is Mary on the far right, who's 3 months pregnant by, at this point. And it looks like she's 6 or 8 months, about ready to pop. And Elizabeth holding the baby there is not too happy that her son just got circumcised, I guess. But anyway, enough of that. Thought I'd make some fun out of that. But what is it about the covenant that caused the people in John's day, as well as the Jewish people down through the ages, to ascribe such meaning, such dedication, and such attachment to it? Why was it so important for them to identify themselves with the covenant? So in this two-part study, we'll take a look at the subject of covenants in order to get a much better understanding of what it means to be in covenant within a Hebraic context. So here's what we're going to do. First off, we're going to study the definition, or try to determine the definition of a covenant. We're going to look at the secular meanings. We're going to look at the Strong's Concordance definition. And then we're going to look at the contextual meaning, which is probably more important for us. And then we're going to take a look at a pattern of biblical covenant, something we've probably not done before. And these pattern of covenants are going to be based on historical secular examples. So I think you're going to be quite amazed when you see what you're going to be seeing here. And then the next time, next week, we're going to take and compare the various Old Testament covenants. We're just going to look at all the various Old Testament covenants. We're going to determine if they stand alone, if they're negated by a later covenant, and then we're going to look at the signs of the covenants. And then finally, we're going to look at the importance of being considered to be in covenant with God. What does it really mean to be in covenant with God? So here we go. What is a covenant? If you were to take and get in on the internet, which is usually right now about the best way to take and search out anything. You can get good and bad information, obviously, from the internet. But one of the easiest ways to search out information nowadays is on the internet. And if you were to get on Wikipedia, which is sort of a standard dictionary on the internet, and look up the word covenant, it will say a solemn promise to engage in or refrain from a specified action. A solemn promise to engage in or refrain from a specified action. Well, sort of a vague definition. Doesn't really tell us an awful lot. So searching deeper, we can find another definition. And this time, it's again from Wikipedia, but from a different search. And it says, a biblical covenant is an agreement found in the Bible between God and His people in which God makes specific promises and demands. All right, well, this is true. This is a proper definition, though I don't think it's a very good contextual definition of what a covenant is. For instance, we've all, any of us that are married or have been married, we were all part of a covenant at one time. Were we not? Okay. It was a covenant of matrimony. We didn't enter into this covenant of matrimony for pure physical reasons. At least we should not have. Most of us did not get married for money. We did not get married because the other person had a really nice car and we wanted to really be able to drive that car. We didn't get married for those things. We often got married, and we should have got married, because of a deep desire and a love for the person that we were going to get married to, right? No one's agreeing, so maybe y'all got married for the other reason that I wasn't going to say, okay? All right, so I would assume that we all got married because we had an outright concern for the person that we're going to get married to. And so we married because of love, right? We married because we had a bond with this person and we wanted to be pleasing to this person. We wanted this person to please us, and all of those good things that we think about when we're into these type of relationships. You know, we're just so excited. So we were so willing to enter into these covenant, this contractual, you might say, agreement with this person because of a love for them. And so we didn't enter into it with the thought that I'm doing this because I've been told to do it, or I'm doing this because this person rules over me or anything like that, right? We got into it because of love. That concept, by the way, has been sort of lost in today's society. I don't know if you've heard, you know, there's more marriages end in divorce than don't end in divorce. That's just sort of a sad fact of life, right? Today, there's a thing called, they're calling it, covenant marriage. How many of you heard the term covenant marriage? Okay. They've started a thing called covenant marriage, where it's a legally binding contract in a marriage where the state cannot allow you to get a divorce without you first going through a number of processes to try to preserve your marriage. In other words, for instance, you would have to take and go to counseling in order to, before you could go, you have to go to marriage counseling before you could go and apply for a divorce or ask for a divorce. This covenant marriage thing is an attempt to try to stem the tide, the rising tide of divorces in America. And it's the reason we have this covenant marriage specifically is because people just forget that the fact that when they got married, they already had entered into a covenant. Or even if they had understood that they were entering into a covenant, they cared less. I mean, they didn't really care about the covenant. The covenant really meant nothing to them. And I would dare say that's one of the big reasons why we have so many divorces nowadays, because people don't really understand the covenant. Or if they do understand the covenant they're entering into, they don't really care about the covenant. It's really not made an impact on them, what they've actually done when entering into it. So a biblical covenant, though, has an aspect of love to it. In ancient Israel, many unions between men and women were arranged. And so there wasn't this attraction this bond of love that caused them to get married. They were oftentimes married as a result of their very dedicated and loving parents trying to find the perfect mate for them. A perfect example of this is the case of Abraham and Sarah, or Abraham, Isaac and Rebekah. But if we remember in the story of Isaac and Rebekah, which was, I think, last week's parashah, when Isaac came, or when Rebekah came after her long trip from Babylon back down to Canaan to see her husband, the very first time she saw her husband, it says that Rebekah went into the tent, or Isaac took Rebekah into the tent of his mother Sarah, and it says then that Isaac loved Rebekah. Well, if you were to look up that Hebrew word there, the Hebrew word there for love is the word ahav, ahav. Ahav is a intimate sounding word. It's sort of the breathy type word, ahav, that is related in some ways to intimacy. But, you know, ahav is the word that most often describes the love that God has for His children Israel. It's the word that describes the relationship that God wants to have with us. And it says that Isaac had that love, like God has a love for us, from the get-go, for Rebekah, a woman he had not even married. A woman he had never met, never betrothed. He never courted this woman. She was just given to him as his wife. So ahav is part of a covenant relationship that we see in the Bible, and that is the marriage covenant that Isaac had with Rebekah. And it says there, Isaac brought her into the tent of Sarah his mother and took Rebekah, and she became his wife, and he loved her. I got a little bit behind on my slides there. And if you want to look that up, that's Strong's 157. So, we want to look then at the word covenant and see then if it includes all of these different aspects that we're talking about in regards to our relationship. Does it contain love? Does it contain all of these things, this devotion, everything that we would think that a covenant should? So let's start out by looking and describing what the actual Hebrew word the Hebrew word for covenant is. In Hebrew, the word is berit, berit, and it's the bet, resh, a yod, and a tav. Bet, resh, yod, and a tav. And there's actually two words used in the Bible for, or two primary words used in the Bible for covenant. Berit is the first. Obviously, that's the one that's used in the Old Testament. And then there's a New Testament word, which is, and I have to look at my notes here, diatheke, diatheke. And I don't know what those little Greek glyphs are, but the word is diatheke. And diatheke is it's really not a really good word to describe, or it's not a real parallel word to berit. Berit is sort of a Hebrew, it's sort of a unique Hebrew thought in a way. Diatheke, though it comes close to that, we'll talk about diatheke later. But one thing about diatheke why it is important is because it is the word that the priest used when they wrote the Septuagint, which is the second century BC translation of the Old Testament into Greek by the Jewish priest. So they use diatheke, so it's good enough for me. So let's look at the word berit a little bit more. Berit. It is Strong's number 1285, and it means an alliance, an agreement, a pledge, a treaty, and a constitution. This is basically Strong's definition. And it comes from the Hebrew word bara, which is Strong's number 1262. And if you can look down there, you'll see the similar Hebrew letters for it. It's basically the same beginning letters Only the ending is different. So it's the same root, primary root word there, bar, is there. And it actually means to cut. The word bara actually means to cut. To Jesenius, the Jesenius Hebrew lexicon, it gives a little bit different definition of berit. It says, a covenant so called from the idea of cutting, since it was the custom on making a solemn covenant to pass between the divided parts of the victims. So, Jesenius adds a little bit more information to it. It goes on to say that the word implies eating together, since it was customary among the Hebrews, as well as the people of the ancient Near East, to eat a meal when entering into a covenant. This tradition may have been carried, and this is not, unquote, this is my thoughts here. This tradition of eating when ratifying or making a covenant may have been carried all the way down to the New Testament, to the times of Messiah Yeshua, because we see Messiah Yeshua, before he was crucified, talking about the blood of the covenant. You're drinking the blood of the covenant. And what were they doing? They were having a meal, right? So the concept of eating a meal is very much a part of the covenant process. Now, there's a fellow named Jeff Benner. Jeff Benner is a self-taught Hebrew linguist. And he's got a website that's called Ancient Hebrew Research Center. Ancient Hebrew Research Center. And on this site, he explains what the word berit means. What the word berit means in the basics of the Hebrew. Now, let me tell you a little bit more about Jeff Benner. Jeff is often quoted by Brad Scott. And Brad Scott's been here before and spoken here before. And Brad refers to Jeff a lot because Jeff is gifted in this area of Hebrewism, Hebrew understanding in these words and the etymology of these words. And so Brad Scott, who is miles and miles above anything that I would know about Hebrew, refers to Jeff Benner. So Jeff has some pretty good insight into a lot of this stuff. And Jeff says this in regards to the word berit. He says, while the Hebrew word berit means covenant, the cultural background of the word is helpful in understanding its full meaning. Berit comes from the parent root word bar, in which I showed you earlier. It's the Beit Resh, which means grain. Grains were fed to livestock to fatten them up to prepare them for slaughter. You ever heard the term, go get the fatted calf? Okay. Two other Hebrew words relate to berit, and also are derived from the parent root bar, which can help understand the meaning of bari. The word bari means fat, and bar root means meat. Notice the common theme with bar, bari, and bar root. They all have to do with slaughtering of animals, or slaughtering of livestock. So what he's saying is that you've got these livestock-related words that are all sharing a very primary root, the Beit and the Resh, with the word berit. And those who study Hebrew, this means something to them. So Jeff goes on to say, the word berit is literally the animal that is slaughtered for the covenant ceremony. The berit is the literal animal that is slaughtered for the covenant ceremony. The phrase, make a covenant, is found 13 times in the Hebrew Bible. In the Hebrew text, this phrase is karat berit. Karat berit. And the word karat is Strong's number 3772. And you'll see this phrase, karat berit, numerous times, like he said, 13 times. And one of the areas that I looked at was 2 Chronicles 29:10. Which you can see there from the context, it even talks about cutting a covenant. So the word karat literally means to cut. When a covenant is made by a fattened animal, or let me restart that. When a covenant is made, a fattened animal is cut into pieces and laid out on the ground. each part of the covenant then passes through the pieces, signifying that if one of the parties fails to meet the agreement, then the other has the right to do to the other what they did to the animal. Do you understand that? Okay, when they cut a covenant, they took an animal, they split it in two, and they laid the parts. Say this is a path going down right down through here. They would put one animal over here, they put one animal over here, and then the two people who were party to the covenant would walk down between these two parts. And the significance was that was to say, if either of us take and fail to uphold our terms of this agreement that we've just made, this covenant we just made, then you have the right to cut me in half. In other words, you have the right to kill me. So making a covenant in that day and age was a little bit more important and taken a little bit more seriously than it is today when we make marriage covenants, isn't it? And so maybe that's why we don't pay as much attention to the covenants God's made and put as much significance on them as maybe we should.
Excuse me, can I ask you a question?
Sure.
Clearly, that would be the case of a covenant between two people that's conditional, whereas some of the covenants that God made were unconditional, and he wouldn't be subject to such a...
Then why would he go through it? Then why would he do it? Okay. My answer would be because it's just important to him. And he would consider that if he were to take and not uphold his terms of the covenant, then that should happen to him. That we're going to go on and we're going to learn more about this, okay? And I think you'll see my point as we go on. Okay, so we see that this is specifically what cutting a covenant means, is that you're willing to take and die in the event you are unwilling to uphold your end of the agreement. Now, the ancient Hebrew, Paleo-Hebrew glyphs for the word berit is what you see right here. We've talked before about how Hebrew is a picture language. And what we're seeing here is the Hebrew word berit spelled out in symbolic picture language. This is second generation Paleo-Hebrew. This is the Hebrew that would have been being used basically from the time of about 200 years before Moses up until about, say, 200 years before King David. There was about a 300-year span that they used this. They call this Proto-Sinaitic. Proto-Sinai, Mount Sinai is what it basically means. All right. And the first two glyphs, Beit is a house, and the second is Resh, which is the head. Resh means head, and you can see that looks sort of like a head. And so those two letters together, Beit Resh, in Hebrew equals son. And it's the thought is that it's the man that comes from the house. The next is the Yud, and it's an outstretched hand. Though it's supposed to be clenched fist, but it's an outstretched hand, which means a work or a deed. And the third is a cross or a sign. Remember back in some of the old movies, and you had these old cowboys that couldn't write their name, and they wanted to buy something from the general store, and they couldn't, they had a little account there, and so they were told to put their mark on the piece of paper or whatever. That's what this is all about. This is about putting your mark or your sign down. But when you look at that, There's a number of meanings that can come from this picture thought here. And one of them is that the sign of the work of the Son, the sign of the work of the Son, is what a covenant is. Another thought would be that a covenant is the cross is the deed of the Son. The cross is the deed of the Son. So take that for what it's worth, but this is definitely and certainly a meaning that could be derived from the ancient Hebrew glyphs of the word berit. Now, let's talk a little bit about the Greek again. The Greeks didn't really have a good equivalent to the word berit, but since it is used in Septuagint, apparently they thought it was a close enough term that they should use it. It is Strong's 1242, and it means an arrangement, a testimony, a compact, and of course, as Strong's normally does, it uses the own word that's trying to describe or define in the definition. It's a covenant. And it comes from the word diathetamaia, whatever that means. I don't know how to pronounce that. And it's Strong's number 1303. But the difference between this, and this is something that sort of slips us up when we look at covenants based only on a New Testament view, is that this word actually means to make final arrangements, which means a will, in other words. And so when we look at, it's the same word, by the way, that we get the word testament from. And so when we look at a covenant in the New Testament and we look at it from the Greek point of view, we're often thinking of something it's for a dying or dead people. People that are getting ready to pass on. But covenants are not that way. Covenants are for living people. And people that have got something to do. They're not for a dying group of people. So let's just leave the diatheke behind and move on and stick sort of with the Hebrew, because I think the Hebrew better defines what we have here. Before we go here, though, I want to say this. When we look back at the definitions given for the word covenant, we notice that the word law is absent. In all the definitions we've seen so far, the word law is not a part of them. And though a covenant can certainly contain law, a covenant in itself is not law. Thus, a change in laws within a covenant would not necessarily mean that you have a new covenant. See what I'm saying? Because laws are part of the covenant and they are within the covenant, then a change in the law does not mean we have a new covenant. For instance, let's take an example that we're all familiar with, and that is the Constitution of the United States. The Constitution is sort of like a covenant. If you were to take and look at the way it's laid out much like a covenant. But the Constitution is a changing document. And it can be changed by we the people, right? But when the document is changed, does that mean we have a new constitution? No, it doesn't. We've got a changed constitution, but we don't have a new constitution. The constitution is still the same. We still have the same document. We've just had an amendment to it. And why did we make amendments to it?
Make it clearer.
Make it clearer, or because maybe circumstances have changed, right? So the circumstances that change and the amendments to it don't necessarily negate what came before, do they? So when they added the Bill of Rights to the Constitution, did it do away with the body of the Constitution? No, it didn't. Okay, when they passed the law back a few years ago, about 80 years ago, where they changed, I think it's the 17th Amendment, where they took and changed it from where the Senate was chosen by the legislatures of each state to where the people themselves voted for the Senate, their own senator. That was a change in the document, It was a change for the worse, in my opinion. But it was a change in the document, but it didn't do away with the document. And it didn't change all the other laws pertaining to the document, did it? All right. So that's a fair example, I could say, of a covenant. There again, a covenant contains law, but it does not law. It is not law. Another example of a covenant is that God and Israel joined into a covenant in Exodus 19, verses 1 through 8. If we read that text, Exodus 19, verses 1 through 8, we see that Israel joined into a covenant with God. But at that time, there was no laws associated with that covenant. Did you ever notice that? Israel said that all that God tells us to do, we will do. And then in Exodus 20, God started spelling out the laws. Okay, so the laws were given after the covenant was established. And so changes of the law within the covenant didn't change the fact that the covenant was still the same covenant. Right? Okay. You may not agree with that. We'll get onto that later as we do questions. In fact, I'll pass on after that. I could go on with that for a long time. But we'll save that for the next time. The relationship between covenant and law can be somewhat confusing. Okay, here we go. The concept of law and covenant and the whole aspect of covenants, when you start combining Hebrew thought, Greek thought, and our own thought into covenants, can be very confusing. Amen. But thankfully for us, there's been some work done over the last 50 years that has begun to really help clear some of this stuff up. At least in my mind, it's cleared it up. And this is what I really want to show you for the remaining time here. And I hope that as we see this, you're going to be able to gain a little bit better understanding of what a covenant really is, and especially the covenants that God made with Israel in the day of ancient Israel. There's been much research and documentation over the past 50 to 60 years by scholars such as George Mendenhall, a guy named Meredith Klein, and others in the realm of ancient Near Eastern treaties. Ancient Near Eastern is the peoples of ancient Assyria, ancient Syria, ancient Babylon. These people made treaties back then, and it's about 50 years ago they started studying some of these because archaeologists started digging up some of these old treaties and realizing what they were. And so they started studying these things. These ancient treaties were between nations that were called suzerain nations and vassal nations. And they were covenants or treaties that are very, very similar to the covenants that we see that God made with ancient Israel. And the findings of these men who have studied these finds, these ancient documents, has shed a lot of light on the intent of God's covenants and help answer many of the questions about them. So we're going to start looking at those. Most of this information that I'm getting ready to present to you is from an article that I found on the internet a long time ago. Actually, this has been referred to by a number of different groups. I was first turned on to this back in 1997 by First Fruits of Zion. I went to a Jars of Clay conference there, and there was a teacher Jewish fellow named Ariel Berkowitz, who referred to this and really started me helping me to understand the role of covenants with the ancient Israelites. But a guy named J.A. Thompson, who is a Ph.D. at some big, high, biblical Baptist university thing, he wrote this article that it's entitled Ancient Near Eastern Treaties and the Old Testament. And you can find this information on the internet. I listed the websites up there, but we'd probably need to put this up later if you're interested in getting those, or you can get them off my website.
Or can we have you email it to us?
Or they'll be on my website, and you can download them off my website. So, a lot of this information we're getting ready to go through is off of this. So, we're going to go through this. There are two types of ancient covenants that the ancient Near Eastern nations dealt with. One of them was called a suzerainty covenant, and the other was called a parity covenant. A suzerainty and a parity. And we're going to define these as we go. A suzerain, in order to understand a suzerain covenant, we need to know what a suzerain is. And a suzerain is simply a nation that controls another nation in international affairs, but allows it domestic sovereignty. A bad example of that is this. After World War II, the United States, we had beat Japan, right? And we basically went to Japan and we set up a government in Japan. And we said, Japan, we're going to look out for you. We're going to take care of your defense. You can't have your own army or anything like that. But you can basically govern yourselves. You're going to be your own separate nation. But we're Big Daddy, okay? And so if you get out of line, we're going to come crush you. Actually, we didn't say that. We should have, but we didn't because we were the victor. But back then, that's the way it would have worked. So you have, that's what a suzerain covenant is. Now, what you have is a big nation again, and then you have a vassal nation, which is normally a smaller nation. And this is not meant to depict the size of the nations. This is made to depict the power of the nation. So you got a big, powerful nation, and then you've got a little small vassal nation, and then you have the enemy out there. And to illustrate then why a nation would want to become a vassal nation to a suzerain nation or to a bigger nation, is there's a number of reasons for it. One of them is that because of a war, the big nation crushed the small nation, and so therefore they're saying, okay, we now control you, and so you're the vassal, you owe us this and that and all that. Another reason for doing so was because you might have the enemy coming in. And you have the small nation that says, hey, the enemy is bigger than me, but over there is a nation that's bigger than the enemy. So let me have an alliance with the big nation, and then the big nation will protect me. And so they would voluntarily become a vassal of the more powerful nation. If you ever read Steve Collins' books, Steve talks about this in the case of the Phoenicians. The Phoenicians actually became vassals of Israel during the time of King David and King Solomon. And they did so because they found out that David, even though David ruled a relatively small nation, David was a big guy. And wherever David went, he won the war. And he was considered a ruthless warrior in many cases. And so therefore, nations found it better to be in an alliance with David than to fight David. And so they would willingly submit. And so you take the vassal nation, and you can see the problem you would have with a vassal nation if they decided to stand on their own. Now all of a sudden, they don't have this bond, they don't have this alliance with the big nation, or the powerful nation, and so the enemy now can get in there and sort of split, get between them and attack. So it's always better to have this type of relation in many of these Middle Eastern nations if you are a rather small nation. Now, not all Middle Eastern or near Middle Eastern covenants back then were of this type, but enough of them were. Some of them were actually agreements between nations, but most of them that we've come to find out were these suzerainty type agreements where a big nation basically took on a smaller nation. And in these suzerainty type agreements, the big nation or the powerful nation said to the smaller nation that we will take and protect you, we will take and watch out for you, we will help you economically, but in return, you are to not have a relationship with any other nations, you are to look to us as your king, basically, and then you're also to take and pay tribute to us in taxes or whatever. And there is a number of other things to do. But most importantly, they were to swear allegiance and fidelity and exclusive loyalty to the suzerain. And in fact, in many of these types of agreements, the term that was used in the event that the vassal nation joined or made an alliance with another nation, the term was that was used and which was written into these documents was adultery. So it would be considered adultery on the part of the vassal nation to take and make an agreement with another nation. And there are a number of reasons this might take place, obviously, but we'll not get into that. We're going to talk about one of them here in a minute. Now, the suzerainty covenant is much like what we see in the book of Deuteronomy. If we were to take and go through the entire book of Deuteronomy, we would find it laid out precisely the way that most common suzerainty agreements or suzerainty treaties were made. A suzerainty covenant had a preamble, which if you go to your Bible, and let's just go to our Bibles here and look at this and spend just a couple of minutes on this. Go to Deuteronomy 1. And you're going to see the preamble of Deuteronomy. And it's basically where Moses is saying, these are the words which Moshe spoke to all Israel on this side of the Jordan in the wilderness. And it says, now in the and it came to pass in the 14th year in the 11th month on the first day of the month that Moses spoke to the children of Israel according to all that the Lord had commanded him, and so on and so on. So this is basically Moses is setting the stage here for what he's getting ready to talk about. The next part of a suzerainty covenant is the historical prologue. And if you were to go on down into Deuteronomy, you would see that from Deuteronomy 1:1-6 through 4:49, God basically then talks about everything that has happened to Israel from the time they came out of Egypt. And what he's doing is he's setting up the stage for why the people would want to take and be under the covenant that he's proposing. Remember, God tells them that he carried them out on eagle's wings. He did all of these things. He killed all these kings, led them through the wilderness. He fed them. Their shoes didn't wear out. All of these things that God did for Israel are spelled out in Deuteronomy 1:6 through 4:49. And what Moses is doing here, and basically what God is doing here, is God is presenting himself as the big ruler, the big king. And not only that, he's saying that I am the one who's able to do these things for you in the event you think that there's someone else out there that could have done these things for you. I am the one who's powerful enough to do these things. And one of the reasons one of the suzerainty kings would say this in the event this was a normal Hittite type arrangement is that he's wanting to establish that if you don't follow the edicts of this covenant, I am able to crush you. So it's very important that this part was included in Deuteronomy. The next we have is the stipulations. And this is where basically in Deuteronomy, Moses lays out the law. All of the different aspects of the law. We know that Deuteronomy, what does Deuteronomy mean? Does anybody know? It's a second telling. Yeah, it's basically the second telling. And in Hebrew, the word is devarim, which means the second words. The second words. So we have the stipulations or the law spelled out then. Next we have in Deuteronomy 31:9, now this is not necessarily all in order, but this is the way it would have been spelled out in a Hittite suzerainty treaty. It has the provisions for treaty deposit and public reading. And if we remember what God tells Moses to do after he writes it all down, he says to take and set it in the in the Holy of Holies alongside the Ark of the Covenant. And then he also says that every 7 years during the Feast of Tabernacles, you're supposed to get this out and read it. Right? Okay. So this is a very common part of a suzerainty treaty. Then there's a list of witnesses to the treaty. And in the case of Devarim, God says he calls heaven and earth to witness against you. So you have the witnesses there. Then, of course, you have the blessings and curses for fidelity or infidelity to the treaty. And look at the words that were used there, fidelity and infidelity. They look at breaking the treaty, you know, breaking the covenant as being adultery. Breaking the treaty is adultery in the terms of the people who wrote these ancient Near Eastern documents. And of course, we know what the blessings and the cursings were. The blessings were that in the event that you follow these laws, that all these good things are going to happen to you. You know, the reaper overtaking the sower. And basically, they would have so much food they couldn't take and keep it all reaped, that God was going to make their crops grow so fast that they would have protection, that one would chase 7,000 and all of that stuff. But there again, on the other side, that if they didn't break or follow the covenant, they broke the covenant, then God said that there would be these curses that would come upon them, ultimately with them being driven from the land. And then finally, in most of these suzerainty covenants, there was accommodations for renewal of the covenant with a change of leadership in the vassal nation. Now, what was the purpose of this? The covenants were considered basically everlasting because none of these kings ever thought they were going to die. Or if they did die, the big king always said, or always thought, you know, my son's going to come in and rule after me. So it's no big concern about my end of the agreement. I'm going to keep my end of the agreement. But just for the sake of you down here, you vassal king, when you die, and whoever takes over for you, that doesn't release your nation from the covenant. When you die, whoever rises up to take your place, that person also is under this covenant. You see? And what happened in the case of Deuteronomy? Do we remember? There was a change in guard. Moses died. And who took over? Joshua. So, to follow the suzerainty structure, then God had to make this provision. He had to provide for the fact of the continuity of the covenant in the event Moses died, which he knew he was going to die. In fact, God was the one who told Moses who was going to be the next king of the vassal nation. Okay.
Is there any significance to your fourth bullet point being where it is instead of at the end, since those verses follow all the others below it?
Well, it's because that was the layout in the suzerainty. The suzerainty covenants were made in this fashion. Okay. Now, God didn't necessarily follow it completely, you know, right down the line of that.
So Jonah, who laid this out, is comparing it to other historical
Yes.
covenants.
Yes.
It's not the order that God put it in the Bible.
That's correct. Okay. Yeah, this is the way that the majority of the ancient Hittite suzerainty covenants were made. And I skipped over this, but I just got a little break here. I'll go ahead and bring this up. A lot of these nations made these suzerainty covenants, but a lot of them were pretty hard on the vassal nation. The Assyrians were pretty hard on the vassal nations. The Syrians were pretty hard on the vassal nations. But the Hittites were basically a people that when they conquered a nation, or if a nation came in under their umbrella, they basically built a bond of love with them. The Hittites were different in many ways. They knew the advantages of having a good relationship with the vassal nation and protecting the vassal nation and taking care of them and wanting to have a good relationship with them. So their suzerainty treaties included this aspect of love, you might say, that the Assyrians and the Syrian and the Babylonians didn't have for the nations that they conquered. Okay, a couple quick ones.
Why is that significant as far as the scriptures?
Well, I think we'll see here in just a minute.
You're saying that the covenant that God made with Israel is most similar to the types that the Hittites made.
Right.
Was there ever any arrangement between the Hittites and Israelites?
Well, Uriah was a Hittite. I mean, Uriah was high up in David's leadership scheme, so maybe...
We don't necessarily have a direct...
We see no covenantites. No. All right, so I'm going to take and... let's take this suzerainty model that we've got here and let's transfer the players here. And instead of the suzerain being just any old king out there, we can now see that this is the great king is Yahweh, okay? The vassal king over here is Israel, the much smaller power in that picture. And then we have Hasatan is the enemy. And of course, Hasatan was the enemy all along. But look at the bond that we want to have. This is what's important, is that we have this bond between the king and the vassal. Because if you don't have this bond, oh, here's Hasatan, he just jumped in there like a little snake. All right. So if you don't have this bond, you see what happens. Then Israel is pretty much stuck out there on their own. Hasatan has a much greater ability to get to Israel. So Israel was much better off having this bond, this covenant with God in order to protect them, just like any suzerain nation would have with its vassal nation, especially in the Hittite realm, because they would take and protect them and watch out for them. Because there's a lot of wolves out there trying to get the people. All right, let me find out where I'm at here. A couple of things about these Hittite covenants that we talked about is that, number one, they did in no way resemble a negotiated contract. The vassal nation never had a bargaining chip when it came to entering into a suzerain covenant. The arrangements started unilaterally in that God was the one, or the greater king was the one who always initiated it. All right. Oftentimes, you know, it was the greater king going out and seeing this little small nation out there and saying, hey, look, you know, they send ambassadors to him and say, hey, you know, you see the storm on the rise here? You know, you come and you pay tribute to us and we'll watch out for you. It's very seldom that the weaker nation would go to the greater nation. Right, yeah. The inferior party or the vassal nation can accept or reject the covenant, but they can in no way negotiate the terms of the covenant. And practically all of these, especially the Hittite covenants, they were confirmed by the cutting of the animal and walking between the pieces. So the cutting of an animal, walking between the pieces, was a very common act in these ancient Hittite nations. And this is quite interesting. In many of the cases of a Hittite suzerainty covenant, the vassal nation, which in our case would be Israel, were required to wear signs. To identify them. And we know that when God made a covenant with Abraham, what did he do? He established a sign. Okay? All right, so we've talked about a suzerainty. Let's talk about a parity covenant, because this is another type of covenant that was predominant in that day and age. It is a covenant of equal standing between parties, though not necessarily equal in status or power. What that means is that, well, I'll just give you an example of it, okay? The Queen of Sheba was married to King Solomon, right? At the time, Solomon was the greatest power around. But yet, arrangements were made, I would assume, between the father of the Queen of Sheba and King Solomon for them to get married. In that case, the King of Sheba, you might say, was basically considered on equal standing. You see what I'm saying? They were both kings, in other words. So, though one power was much greater and could crush the other, they were still both on equal standing. And so that respect was given in that regards. In ancient Israel, Hebraic weddings, you would have two fathers come together and they would discuss their children if they were going to get married, or if, you know, they were going to become betrothed to one another. Both the fathers were on equal standing. Now, maybe one of them was much richer than the other, but they were still considered to be on equal standing in that regards. You see what I'm saying? So, There's equal standing, though not necessarily equal in status or power. Most of the parity covenants, though, that we do see are unilateral in origin, but bilateral in operation. What that means is that in most cases, one party went to the other party and said, "Hey, I would like to marry. I'd like for my son to marry your daughter." But once they started the negotiations, it was a bilateral thing. In other words, the father of the bride could say, "Well, if your son's going to marry my daughter, he's going to have to do this." And the father of the bride say, or the groom would say, "Well, you know, if he's going to marry your daughter, this and this is going to have to take place." So it was unilateral in origin, but bilateral in operation. They followed the Hebrew betrothal and marriage pattern that we see. I'm not going to necessarily talk about that. That's been talked about a number of times here. It was normally initiated by the greater power, which were there again, unilateral in origin. It was usually initiated by the richer of the persons in this regard, or the more prosperous nation. And it is often the case where the most prosperous nation would see a woman over here or want to maybe a trade relationship with another kingdom. And so one of the best ways to open up this trade relationship would be to take and marry someone from that other nation. So you got the prince from the great nation saying, "Okay, there's the princess over here in the weaker nation. I want you two to get married so that we can have a working relationship and so we can have trade back and forth." This was a common reason for this. These are usually based on love to some degree, especially within the Hebraic concept. And they required stipulations in most cases, where in the case of many of the Hittite, it was like the Jewish or the Hebrew ketubah. And I don't know, do you remember what the ketubah is? A ketubah was a written document in a Jewish wedding where the man and the woman, they would write out all the things that they were going to do for each other, and it was basically a written binding contract. You guys probably had a ketubah, didn't you? Gary, you and Carolyn? Did y'all do a ketubah?
No.
You didn't do a ketubah? All right. Oh. You should have done a ketubah, huh? All right. But a ketubah is basically a statement of what you will do and what you won't do, okay? And in a Hebrew wedding, it's a legal contract, pretty much. I mean, you are bound legally to this. So that's a parity covenant, and we do see those quite often in these Hittite nations, these Middle Eastern nations. But we also see that in the Bible too. And so I'm not going to go through that right now, but the Exodus 19 covenant relationship that we saw just a minute ago was sort of a marriage type parity covenant, in which God was coming down to Israel and basically courting Israel. God had not conquered Israel. He had delivered Israel But he was saying, hey, do you want to be my wife? Is basically the way that all took place. And so we see, in essence, two types of covenants happening in Exodus 19 and on through the end of the Bible. Quick, Kathy.
Okay, so the marriage covenant, the covenant of Mount Sinai, was a parity covenant.
I think it was both, but it was very clearly a parity covenant.
Okay, but the other kind of covenant was, the example was Abraham and Yahweh walking through the park.
Well, as we go through the covenant, we're going to try covenants. We're going to try to determine that, but I think we're going to see that the suzerainty type covenant is the overlying covenant for the entire thing. Is what we'll we'll see, but we'll go through that. No, the parity covenants didn't, because they're more of a marriage type covenant. They were a marriage covenant. So, with all this information that we've gotten so far, I'd like to take and define, at least give my definition for a covenant. A covenant is a treaty or an oath, but most importantly, it is a bond of love. And I submit to you that as we go through the covenants that God made with Israel, we're going to see that the overlying factor is the love that God has for Israel. But just for a sneak preview of that, there are a couple of passages I do want us to read. One is Deuteronomy 7, verses 6 through 8, where it says, "For you are a holy people to Yahweh your God. The Lord your God has chosen you to be a people for himself, a special treasure above all the peoples on the face of the earth. The Lord did not set his love on you, nor choose you because you were more in number than any other people, for you were the least of all peoples. But because the Lord loves you, and because he would keep the oath which he swore to your fathers." That word love there is a different word than the one we talked about before. This word is not ahav. This word is hazak. Hazak. In the Strong's number 2836. And it means to love, but to be attached to. It means to be attached to.
Attached emotionally or
physically? Well, that's for us to determine. But because God wants to be attached to us, or God wants to be attached to us because of the covenant he swore to the fathers. Do we really understand what it means for God to want to be attached to us?
That would also be related to being grafted into the vine.
Oh yeah, all of it does. Mm-hmm. I think it's an amazing thing that the supreme being of the universe wants to be attached to us. And then in Joshua 22, verse 5, "Only be careful to observe the commandment and the law that Moses, the servant of Yahweh, commanded you, to love the Lord your God and to walk in all his ways and to keep his commandments and to cling to him." See that? Cling to him. "And to serve him with all your heart and with all your soul." The word there, love, is ahav. Ahav. So let's review real quickly what we've got. The Hebrew word for covenant is barit, which means a pledge, an allegiance, an alliance. But in regards to the covenants of God, they include the aspect of love. Though covenants may contain laws, covenants in themselves are not law. There are two types of covenants between God and man. The Hittite suzerainty covenant structure, where a strong nation or a king subjects a weaker king. And it includes the cutting of the pieces and usually includes some type of covenant sign. And then there's the parity covenant in the form of a marriage contract. So, shalom aleichem, peace be unto you. The next time we will take and discuss these other aspects, go through some of these covenants, and I hope that at the end of this entire study, we're going to have such a devout love and appreciation for the covenant, or at least a more devout appreciation of the covenant than we've ever had before.